right, man. Welcome to Crow 777 Radio. This is hour one of episode 671. Jason Lindgren is with me and Wayne McCroy joins us. We're going to be covering the dream state, specifically nightmares, and also how that relates to the equestrian class. It's a funny thing. You can look at almost any culture and you will find that dreams were a big deal. They paid attention to them. They treated them as if they had meaning. You will hear things about out-of-body travel, about different dimensions like the astral. You will hear things about the silver thread that supposedly connects us while we are in the dream state. But we're going to get into the less pleasant side of dreams, and that is nightmares and how they relate. Anyhow, welcome, Jason.
And a rather pleasant good afternoon.
Welcome back, Wayne.
Hi, guys. Always good to be here. Pleasure to be back on.
Wayne, as always, it's an absolute pleasure to have you here, and I'm really looking forward to digging into this very interesting topic that you've come up with.
All right, well then let's jump in, and I guess it's all you, Jason.
The horse is a hugely important archetypal symbol with multiple layers of meaning. We have discussed in the past the notion of equestrian language and its connection to the phonetic Kabbalah, but there are much deeper spiritual connotations to be explored.
Well, it's quite obvious that the word mare, which refers typically in our time to a female horse, is involved, but I'll cue you up, Wayne. Go ahead.
Well, we've discussed in the past when you see in ancient texts and things like that, they're discussing certain families are of the equestrian class. Well, we've discussed this. This means something a lot more detailed and different than what people would anticipate there. These weren't just people that raised horses and this kind of thing, as you would believe now. The equestrian tag that goes into the linguistic programming here is designating something entirely different. And this does relate to the phonetic Kabbalah. And not only is it telling you about these families of antiquity having a connection through the phonetic Kabbalah, it's also telling you there's a deeper spiritual connotation attached to that. And we'll get a little more into that as we go through the notes here, because this notion of the horse, and particularly this correlation or connection between the horse and the rider, becomes apparent when we begin to delve into the history of how the term nightmare came about. And we'll see that there's spiritual attachments and connotations associated with this, and it has to do with some of the belief systems across various cultures about demonic possession connected to it as well. So we'll see. It's an important thing that we'll be touching on here, and maybe people will walk away from this episode knowing a little bit more about this symbol that is the horse and the many things it's attached to.
Well, it's interesting. As you begin to look this up over and over, you come across the idea of the horse and its rider, but that gets inverted in certain usages, and I know we'll touch on that. Anyhow, go ahead, Jason.
The term horse and its associated equestrian language is a veiled reference to subtle, and sometimes not so subtle, spiritual attachments that affect the human being.
Now, Wayne, before I did the dive on this, when we were prepping up for this, I was unaware of the inversion of the horse and the rider, where the horse is actually riding the human, but I know you did notes on that.
Yes, absolutely. This is something you encounter in various cultures, and it doesn't really seem to matter which one that they apply the term horse or rider to. It's about the relationship between the two. That's the important facet of it here. So even though they have this inverse in some cultures, the important connotation to remember is just this connection and the whole allegory that we're being shown here with the language of the horse and the rider and the connection between all of this. And this will become a lot more apparent to the listeners as we continue through the notes here and get into the meat of the matter.
Well, before I hand it back to Jason, if I'm not mistaken, this is the Chinese year of the horse.
It's the year of the fire horse, and this is of utmost importance right now because they are utilizing this archetype to the utmost right now in all the things they're doing. This is a year of major transformation and change, and sometimes destructive transformation and change. And aren't we seeing that? It seems like they're going about provoking the apocalypse, and I think we talked about that off air a little bit right now, by invoking all of these different things on the world stage right now politically. So we see that, especially with the events happening in the Middle East right now.
Yeah, it does appear that, what was the Masonic guy's name there? The guy way back who predicted World War III, Pike. It looks like we're beginning to see Pike's prediction what was it, 2 weeks ago, we were told by our government we're going in for a short while. They've already lengthened that. And just this morning, someone told me, do they say 15 nations are already involved? Something like that. Anyhow, that's a bit off topic. Go ahead, Jason.
How exactly did bad dreams come to be known as nightmares? Origins of the mare, mythological creature. The mare in nightmare does not refer to a female horse, but to an evil spirit or goblin from Old English M-A-E-R-E, believed to torment sleepers. Physical manifestation. This creature was thought to press down on a person's chest, causing paralysis, a feeling of suffocation, and frightening visions, a phenomenon now associated with sleep paralysis. Linguistic roots. The term comes from Proto-Germanic maron, M-A-R-O-N, related to the Indo-European root M-E-R, meaning to harm or to rub away, also found in words like murder. Evolution of the term. Early usage. Around the 13th century, nightmare referred specifically to this oppressive spirit and the experience of being hag-ridden or suffocated. Generalization. Over time, the meaning broadened from the specific physical sensation and demon to encompass any frightening or distressing dream, even without the feeling of suffocation by the 1800s. In essence, the word describes the cause, the night spirit, before it described the effect, the bad dream. Voodoo is the animistic religion of the rural population of Haiti, a former French colony which, for more than 150 years, has been an independent republic populated chiefly by the descendants of imported African slaves. The Haitian peasant believes that the world is ruled by a master, supreme dispenser of all worldly goods, who punishes the sinner and rewards the virtuous. He also regulates the seasons, giving donner droughts, which burns the crops, as well as rains, which moisten the soil. Lightning is his wrath. Riptides and earthquakes are his vengeance. The ups and downs of human fortunes are proof of his infinite power. The master does not act directly, however. He usually manifests himself through the medium of his deputies, i.e., of gods and goddesses, to whom he delegates or upon whom he bestows his powers, and whose intimate contacts with mankind enable them to intervene day after day in human affairs. These divinities are called the Loa, or spirits. The Loa manifest their presence by means of possession. This type of relationship between spirits and mankind is rather widely distributed and is known to occur not merely in Africa and among American Indians, but in many other parts of the world as well. The Loa possess human beings by bestriding, monter, and by riding them as though they were horses. The Loa who possess a human being is able to regulate the conduct of his human horse, causing the possessed to be innocent, contrary, perverted, good, or evil. Sometimes the possessed act as though they were children. At other times, they seem barely able to drag their bodies along as though they were old persons, hobbling along on crutches. Regardless of whether the possessed act like children or like old persons, they frequently display a tendency to commit theft and also manifest other foibles, character traits, and modes of behavior which differ from those which they exhibit in their normal state. Last but not least, the Loa sometimes invade even the sexual life of their servants. Thus, some of the Loa are thought to become the spouses of the possessed, inducing their human mounts either to remain chaste or else to become homosexual. In brief, the state of possession seems to be a state of dissociation, characterized by a return of the repressed and brought about by massive invasion of the ego by id representatives. The possessed disclaim all responsibility for their acts and profess to be merely the horses of the Loa possessing them. They allege that it is their Loa who induces them to gossip, slander, lie, steal, prophesy, strike persons, or caress them, etc. In brief, it is the Loa who induces the possessed to be good or evil, since the latter is merely the horse ridden by the Loa.
And there's the inversion, and this shows up in a number of places where the nightmare is like the horse, but in these cases, the spirit is treating the human being or taking control of the human being. But Wayne, I've got to mention, isn't it interesting from the earlier paragraph, the word mare, where it's spelled here, M-E-R, but the moon is associated. They named way back the guy we just covered from the 1600s end up naming parts of the moon Mar or Mare. And there's a relation there vis-a-vis that the moon is always associated with the dream state, sleeping, death, these types of things. I mean, what do you think?
Oh, most certainly there's that connection there. And there's also the connection back to water as well. Mar also being a root word for maritime and various other things relating to the sea. So we have all of those connections, and that's always associated with the moon as well. So we're talking about the nighttime, and this is an important concept too. So the moon is an archetype within this whole framework. It's a symbol that represents a lot of different things. But what we're talking about here, this transcends just merely a dream state right now or a bad dream. This is the origins of where the term nightmare comes from. Now, in the modern parlance, we think of a nightmare as nothing more than just a bad dream. Well, we see there's a rich history to the term nightmare and why this was applied in the way that it is. And a lot of people have probably never thought about that. Why do they call a bad dream a nightmare? What's the correlation or relationship to the horse? Well, here we are. This is talking about the early usage of the term in the 13th century, talking about being hag-ridden. And of course, this is going back to the concept of the incubus or the succubus and what we would call in the modern day sleep paralysis. We've seen an awful lot of discussion surrounding sleep paralysis in the modern era relating to this type of a sensation. And there might be something more to it. There's definitely a spiritual connotation to it and an attachment thereof. And we'll get a little deeper into that here as we progress further here. But that, I think those are some of the important things to point out here. This is where the term nightmare comes from. And we see it's always important to go back to the linguistic roots and the etymology of these terms to really figure out where did it come from? Why is it referred to in the way that it is? And how do we get there? And of course, this other source that we're reading from here, this comes from the Vaduan culture. So this is where we get this notion. And we'll see as we get further down the notes here, there's other cultures that have the same type of ideologies that they have dealt with too. So this tells me that there's a tenet of truth to all of this. If you have multiple cultures that are disparate from one another, that don't have any connection one to another, and they are telling you the same type of thing, there's a kernel of truth to it. So we need to be aware of that.
I think our culture is the odd man out here, Wayne. We are the only culture that I've looked into that don't take dreams seriously at some level. But like the sleep paralysis, that has even made it into Western art. You can look up old paintings right now where there's like a hag or a ghoul of some sort perched on the chest of someone. There's also a whole kind of mythology about cats stealing the breath of babies, which relates to what we're talking to. But go ahead, Jason, take us further in here.
Therefore, we could see that the horse is associated with a demonic or negative spiritual attachment, sometimes acknowledged to be a night spirit. What is the nature of this type of spiritual attachment? The connotation conveyed through the esoteric application of equestrian language denotes that, through the possession of some negative spirit, the human being becomes the horse, and the possessing spirit becomes the rider. In some mythological or religious belief systems, these terms are inverted, but for understanding the consistent meaning, we recognize the human being as the horse and the possessing spirit as the rider.
To me, what it's saying is basically you don't have the power in this situation. And there's a lot of cautionary tales. As I was looking into this, there's things like there's cultures that won't put mirrors by their beds because they say when they've left into the dream state to go to the astral or wherever it is they're going, they could be confused by the mirror and get trapped on the way back. There are other accounts from the modern era of people doing remote viewing. And time and again, they talk about sentinels where they get there, they don't have the power, and there's a sentinel saying, you can't come here. Furthermore, there are accounts of people coming back to a place in remote viewing, which is similar to dreaming, where they've been told not to go there, and they've been trapped. And there are claims that there are people laying in hospital beds in this world today in a coma because they were trapped while they were remote viewing. It's hard to authenticate any of these things, but I will add, Wayne, that when you read enough accounts, it's like you say, there's got to be something to it.
Oh, absolutely. I would agree and concur with that, because from what I've studied and researched and the things that I've seen, it certainly seems that when human beings are asleep, or as you're expressing here about the remote viewing claims and things like that, when they're in that altered state of consciousness, when they're sleeping, this leaves them vulnerable on the spiritual side of things to the influence of these spiritual intelligences. So this is one of the reasons why this connotation has been hugely attached to dreaming and to sleeping and stuff like that. Because when we're in that state, now this is according to many of the systems that I've looked at, I like to invoke the Rosicrucian system because I think it gives you the most consistent language for describing these things. So they claim that when we go to sleep at night, all right, we have our four basic vehicles that we exist within and throughout, through the different spiritual realms and things like that. So we have the mental body, we have the astral body, we have the etheric body, and we have this physical body that we are all familiar with. So when we go to sleep, the physical body and the etheric body stay in your bed, and at that time, the astral body and the mental body separate from that, and they wander during the dream state. And this is wherein we now have this opening that leaves us vulnerable within our etheric body, because our ontological self, the I am within man, has now left the building for a brief period of time while we dream and our physical body and our etheric body rejuvenate. So this is one of the connotations that's made here. When we're in that sleeping state, we become more vulnerable. Our etheric form becomes more vulnerable. And this is wherein we could pick up the negative spiritual attachment and the become the horse for this disembodied rider, or as they call it in the Vaduan language, the Loa. That's what they refer to this spirit as. So there's a lot of different terms that are used with this from different cultures, but it's the same basic implication there. And we need to beware. And this has everything to do with what's known as the etheric double. And we'll get a little further into that. I think I have more about that further down in the notes.
Well, you bring up the Rosicrucian connection. If you look at some of those old writings, you can learn about the idea that there's a silver thread. I think they say it goes from your navel or something like that. And it's attached to you as you leave to go to the dream state. There are different accounts. I know the other place, the Monroe Institute, talks about this, where when you're new to it, you can only go so far. As you get better, you can go further. There's lots of different ideas. But in the Rosicrucian writings, there is the idea that when you go into the dream state, and I think they use the word astral, I'm not sure, I don't remember for sure, but the idea is there's bad neighborhoods where you're about to go. And depending on what level your resonance is and your mindset and your state of consciousness determines whether you're more likely to go to a seedy neighborhood where things aren't so great or a better neighborhood. But they go further to even divide it down beyond just a bad neighborhood where there's different levels. The higher you go, the better. Are you familiar with any of this, Wayne?
Yes, I am familiar with some of that. And this is one of the things that's said. It depends upon basically what your emotional state is in some of this, and maybe how spiritually connected you are in some of your other abilities and things like that as to where you go. But as you said, there are kind of bad neighborhoods out there. You could run into some bad astral entities.
Right.
You need to be careful. And one of the other claims that is made through much of the literature, not just Rosicrucian, but Rosicrucian inclusive, is that if some point, if you're in this dream state, you're astrally projecting or something like that, and that silver cord gets broken, then you die. And this is something that's been explored by a lot of the different occult secret groups and stuff like that that look at these things as well. So you need to be careful, but it's very difficult for that silver cord to be broken. And it's only when we are at our physical end here in this physical earth is when that breaks during the natural life cycle of a human being. So it's something that is open for debate as to how it actually operates or what could possibly sever that connection. But we have that connection, even though it is said that our astral and our mental bodies leave behind our etheric and physical bodies in the bed. But this does create that position where we become vulnerable to spiritual attachments and spiritual attacks. And that's the important connotation here and why it attaches to the dream state or the nightmare situation.
Well, even the cord idea is echoed in the old Greek mythology with the three sisters and the single eye that was made so famous in that one movie with the claymation in it. That they're when someone's going to die, they have the scissors and they cut the thread. But it also relates what you were just saying, Wayne, to the people. We covered this when we were doing schizophrenia. There are people who now put forward that all addiction is influenced or even caused to some degree by these entities from the bad neighborhoods we were talking about. But that's kind of a different avenue. So go ahead, Jason, and I think we need to take it through 9.
This implies that during the occurrence of possession, the rider has limited control over the horse, the human being. It may appear that the individual is acting of their own accord, but the influence of the possessing spirit takes control under certain circumstances. Haitian voodoo beliefs give us a very good description of what this possession looks like in terms of the mechanics of the situation. The possessing spirit is called a loa in the Haitian documentation. The notion of the horse and rider motif in regard to possession is not a uniquely Haitian idea. There are various other cultures that describe the same thing. Suriname. The beliefs of the Bush Negroes of Suriname, who, like the Haitians, are descended from Negro slaves, resemble Haitian beliefs rather closely. The Bush Negroes call the possessed the horse, Asi, A-S-I, of the possessing spirit. An analysis of the plural meanings of the word Asi will shed some light upon the unconscious meaning of possession. In ordinary parlance, Asi means merely horse. In the figurative sense, it means, however, the person who carries the spirit or the servant of the spirit. The word Asi is used in still another sense by the Fon Yu-speaking tribes of Togo and Dahomey. In this region, the word Asi, used in a religious context, denotes the wife of the spirit. It seems probable that some of the feminine connotations of the word Asi continue to survive among the Bush Negroes, since possessed men sometimes wrap large kerchiefs about their loins in token of their temporary femininity.
This is almost a submissive. The whole thing we're talking about to me, Wayne, is just pointing to submissiveness. And what they're doing is they're correlating it to the horse, but there's a reason for that. It's probably the same reason. If I had to throw out a wild educated guess, it's like having a bull in the zodiac. And then the question will come up, well, what was first, bullishness or the bull? It's that idea. The bull is there for a reason because bullishness is a real thing. And even today we use that on Wall Street. When there's a bull market, that's bullishness or a usage of the idea of bullishness. So when we come back to what you've laid down here, Wayne, it's like you're submissive to the spirit who is now steering you.
Right. That's essentially what they're talking about here. This has come about as a type of ritualistic tradition within these various cultures. They see these loa or these spirits, not necessarily as much of a negative entity or attachment. They see it as part of their cultural and religious practice. They see allowing that spirit to do what it wants with them as being part of that. So it is about this submissiveness angle of things, and it does have them connected to this attachment in ways wherein they are kind of the submissive spouse of sorts, if you want to put it that way. So there's a kind of a feminine connotation attached to it in the traditional sense, but it goes a lot deeper than just that as well. And that's only just one culture we just covered, and there's a couple other ones that it goes into here as well. So there's these connotations of this attachment from these spiritual entities, and it gives the whole idea of the human being being a horse. And think about this in terms of horseback riding, or what is known about horseback riding to a human being. Now, if you are somebody who does equestrian stuff with horses or things like that, you'll understand a little better the connotation that's being implied here. It's not a perfect control you have over the horse, but you can guide and steer the horse in certain directions you want. And oftentimes, this is what this looks like in the actual physical real world sense. These spirits can direct people to go in certain directions, and they use certain tools to go about that. So think about horse riding again. You have a saddle, and you have a bit and bridle so that you could steer the horse in a generalized direction, but you don't directly control all of its motor movements or things like that. It's the same kind of connotation being made here. You don't control exactly what the horse does, but you could train it or guide it to go in certain directions. And that's what the connotation is here. So these spiritual attachments come in and they entrain us into certain ways of behaving. And it's about our submissiveness to that being broken like the horse is. So think about it in those types of terms as well.
Well, it's built into the name as well, the submissive or female idea. We're talking about a nightmare, not a night stud or colt or stallion. It's a nightmare.
In Libya, according to Osterreich, Tremeyn found that the Libyans apply the term horse not to the possessed, but to the possessing spirit. If this information is correct, the Libyan possession pattern is a direct rather than an inverse representation of the nightmare experience. One of Tremeyn's informants stated that he did not know how the spirit horse entered him. Quote, "He is sitting on me. His legs are on my neck and shoulders, and yet he is within my head." As in Haiti, the possessed dancer must wait until the spirit has mounted him completely and is well seated in the saddle. Sometimes the possessing spirit slides about in the saddle, causing his mount to act. According to the Libyans, it is dangerous to give the possessed person anything to drink while he is in a state of possession. It is also noteworthy that, just like the Haitians, the Libyans who call these spirits bori tend to equate them with the wind. Summing up, in Libya, the possessing spirit is spoken of as a horse, although, at the same time, the possessed human being is spoken of as the mount of the spirit.
Go ahead, Wayne.
So we see here there's kind of an inversion of the language in the Libyan culture in regards to this, but it's describing the same thing, essentially. And we see how this person who was interviewed here, who experienced this, he said, his legs and neck are on my shoulders, and yet he is within my head. So he's talking about this spiritual attachment that seems to be steering and guiding and directing him. And how does he do it? By controlling the man's head. Much like you do with a horse. How do you change the direction a horse goes? You use your bit and bridle to steer its head in a certain direction. So when you look at the whole connection or comparison here to horseback riding, you could see how apt that all of this is within this tradition. So they're also saying here, there's certain things that you don't want to do when you notice that a person is possessed in this way. And sometimes in these cultures, this was part of a ritualistic tradition they did. They willingly allowed themselves to be possessed by these spirits, by these bori, as they say here in the Libyan culture. So it's part of their religious rites. So they open themselves up to these spiritual attachments on purpose in many regards. And sometimes they have negative outcomes because of that. And sometimes they may claim to have positive outcomes because of that. But the important thing here is there's also this propensity to compare it to the wind or the elemental air factor. And that's an important thing that we'll discuss here shortly.
You know, early on YouTube, there used to be clips that you could find from Africa where they were doing exactly that. The whole tribe was gathered together. They were having a dance and they were calling on spirits. And this is before AI, and like a grass hut, not as big as a hut, but kind of like a grass hut would be imbued, they were saying, with a spirit, and it was dancing around. The video wasn't great, but there were lots of people and lots of comments who said they were familiar with having seen this. My point being, we're aware of a lot of cultures who did similar things to give rise to spirits and imbue some inanimate object with the spirit, which almost certainly relates to what we're talking about here. But Jason, let's do Northern Ethiopia.
Northern Ethiopia. According to Laris, the possessed human horse is ridden by a czar spirit. The act of possession is described in terms which constantly refer to equestrianism. Quote, the czar is agitating his horse. During possession, guri, the horse is unconscious, etc. The northern Ethiopians' conception of the relationship between the czar and human beings closely resembles the relationship between a strict parent and an intimidated, dutiful child. Thus, it is believed that the czar constantly intervene in the daily affairs of men and hedge them about with a network of strict taboos. They also protect the faithful from illness, guide them through the crises of life, marriage, divorce, the birth of twins, etc., and punish them for their sins. The czar never lose sight of their human charges. They watch them constantly and even spy upon them. Sometimes the czar descend upon the human horse as suddenly as a swarm of bees. The Ethiopians, therefore, deem it advisable to make their peace with the czar and to propitiate them by means of oaths, vows, and sacrificial offerings. The sexual nature of this relationship between the czar as parent surrogates and the human being as a feminized, dutiful child is also underscored by the fact that the act of possession is specifically compared to sexual relations.
In other words, it's very intimate, but I would point out, we covered egregores not too long ago. Think about what it means if you have a whole culture that believes what we're laying down here. They participate in it. They do sacrifices to it. How is it that an egregore, or what we call an egregore, wouldn't be involved here? Wayne?
And that's absolutely the whole point here. I mean, this creates this whole energetic network effect altogether, empowering this type of a spirit all the more. And it says here that this czar spirit, it spies on people. It's constantly watching over you. This does sound like a lot like an egregore, doesn't it? Especially when you're talking about an entire culture that surrounds this whole idea. And we do see the very predatory nature here involved when it's saying it's as a feminized, dutiful child to an overbearing parent in a sexualized type relationship in this way. And then you wonder what's going on with things like the Epstein files and all of this stuff that's come out recently. Is there a spiritual attachment there with some of these people that are participating in these horrific acts? I think it's very possible.
Well, at the end of the day, we've become aware in the modern era about how powerful the human thought form is. And we're beginning to put together, this is part of the reason so much effort has been made to mislead us in almost every way that has been possible to mislead us, from our history, to our calendars, to the way we work, to our money system, to our school, and to the thing we call medicine that typically doesn't heal much of anything at this particular point in time. And we're beginning to put together, it's because it's all been designed to hold down the human thought form. And when we covered egregores and other things, what we're covering here puts another level onto the human thought form. But Jason, let's cover the Maasai before we move on.
The Maasai, this tribe, which lives near the bend of the Niger River, believes that if one dreams of being bitten by a horse, it means that one is being watched by, or even spied upon, by a witch. This belief is a rather interesting one since, in the Maasai language, the term nightmare does not include any element which designates the horse in any manner whatsoever. For this reason, the Maasai belief concerning dreams about horses strongly underscores the nexus between horse and nightmare.
Well, before I throw it to Wayne, I'll just point out that our zodiac, which goes back as far as we can see, has a horse represented in the half man, half horse. And of course, that representation is the idea of horsiness, or the way a horse acts, the way a horse is, a horse's energy. And so we see direct parallels to nature. And it's no different than the bull or anything else we could point to. If we go over to China, what do they have in their zodiac? A bunch of animals. It's a similar idea. But the difference that we don't really have in our culture is because that all relates directly to nature, where all truth resides. And so much of what we're reading is trying to describe basically facets of nature that are being assigned to any given experience. Wayne?
Yeah, and we're so disconnected from the natural world and all of these natural things and concepts that we largely don't see it in our modern Western culture here. We don't acknowledge what's being invoked here and what's being inferred, and we don't recognize the spiritual connection or connotation with these things. You see, it's all about the archetype, and we lose so much information about the archetype when we're disconnected from nature. It's the same thing could be said about our lack of knowledge about mythology in the modern era here as well. So we're missing a big portion of the picture. And most people don't even think about anything like this. When they hear the term nightmare, well, they just think, okay, bad dream. That's it. They don't question it any further and think, hey, wait a minute. Why in the world would they name something like this after an animal? And they don't put two and two together and connect back to the whole concept of the archetype that's associated with it, or the information they could garner from the natural world about this and relate it to why this correlates to this dream state. And this is something that I think is a challenge here, especially to our modern mindset. We've been so indoctrinated with modern scientism and other ways of thinking that it's far removed from our culture at this point, where we don't recognize the connotations being inferred when we see these natural energies being invoked here. And they're talking about the archetype that is the horse, the symbol that is the horse and the things that it represents, that state of horsiness, like you said, Crow. They don't see what is the behavior pattern with that, and they don't connect it to the spiritual side of things either. And there are these spiritual components that are massively important in our world, and we disregard them because we've just been so set in this hyper-materialist paradigm that we miss it. And I think that just exploring these avenues of thought and looking at this and these belief systems of these other cultures and seeing the connection and connotation there to the potential of spiritual entities or intelligences, whatever you want to call them, being able to attach themselves to a person in this way has been overlooked by our modern culture. They disavow all of that. They don't want anything to do with any type of spiritual concern of that way, shape, or form. They would like for you to believe it's nothing but foolishness and nonsense when nothing could be further from the truth.
I think it's intentional. I think that the first steps that are taken when you're going to subjugate large groups of human beings is you have to separate them from truth. And since truth resides in nature, that's where it starts. And I can give an example. Consider when the car came online, what happened to our relationship with horses. It changed drastically and it changed quick. And most of us don't have much of an idea what horsiness even is, to use a word that's not really a word, but you know what I'm talking about. It's like bullishness, that sense of energy that does belong to a horse. If you have never been anywhere on a farm or anywhere and you go visit and you go into a stable where horses are and you smell a horse, it's like that's the sweat of the horse, that's the manure of the horse, but it is not offensive at any level. It hits you at a primordial level that most people don't think about, but you should think about it. Consider the animals in this world that have such a close relationship with us that you can't really imagine what the evolution of human beings would have been without them. Of course, dogs is one of them, but horses are absolutely one of them. And the minute the artificial internal combustion engine came online, how we used and how we related to horses started to change so quickly. And that separation is what has steered us towards the scientism of today, in my view. You want to add anything to that, Wayne?
No, I think that pretty much hits the nail on the head. There's just so much that we're disconnected from, really. That's what it boils down to, especially like if you don't have that type of experience, if you've never been on a farm or never been around horses, you don't see it and you don't know what the connotation is and you don't recognize the archetype or know what the natural energy that's being present there is all about. So you lose sight of all of that stuff.
In Western culture, a lot of people still have an extreme fascination and interest in horses and will go to great expense to have them just so they can ride them.
We have modern examples of what we're talking about through the Amish. Most people feel that if something really drastic happens as we shift into this new era, societies like the Amish will be the least affected. Well, what's the difference? The difference is they're still connected to the land.
Right. And there's this connection a human being has with a horse and that a horse has with a human being. It's a relationship. And that's the important thing that's being referred to here in this type of documentation that we're reading from. There's an intrinsic relationship that does exist between the two, because horses have been domesticated and used by human beings for quite some time. And they're a very useful pack animal of sorts, if you want to call it a pack animal. They provide transportation, they provide muscle, they provide all kinds of services for human beings, and human beings often have emotional attachments to these animals. And horses are interesting, and they have different properties to them on a spiritual side that make them interesting as well. And I've noticed that they are oftentimes used in Rosicrucian literature to describe certain aspects of the etheric body. So this is an interesting connection in and of itself as well.
And even as the connection was severed as the automobile came online, how did we describe the power of an automobile? Well, we went back to nature and we said, this engine's equivalent to this many horses, so it's this much horsepower. So even as we separated from it, we had to go back to the truth to try to put a meaningful idea in someone's mind to what we're talking about. And that really says it all. You know, you've got this artificial thing that's got power, but what do you do to try to communicate to that someone? You go back to what they know. And what do they know? They know a horse. And I think that speaks for itself.
In Asian traditions, the wind horse is a symbol for the human soul. There's a notable connection between the dream state and possession. The horse in the rider dynamic provides an archetypal framework for better understanding the nature of what occurs when a person becomes possessed. The data just presented reveal a rather intimate nexus between the subjective experience of a nightmare and the highly ritualized and institutionalized experience of possession. The most striking feature of this nexus seems to be the role which horses and riding play in both of these phenomena. Furthermore, in view of Jones' demonstration of the unconscious tendency to identify the horse with the rider, one need not be surprised to find that in one area at least, it is the possessing spirit rather than the mounted human who is spoken of as the horse, nor that in possession, the nightmare experience should be repeated, with the difference that in possession, the ridden human rather than the riding spirit is usually designated as the horse. The data also tend to support Jones' thesis that the nightmare experience is closely related to the incest and primal scene problem, the nightmare horse and the possessing spirit being symbolic of the sexually aggressive parent. The history of the domestication of the horse also throws some light upon this problem. It is rather probable that the first animal domesticated in Central Asia was the horse. It should be remembered in this context that, at that time, Central Asia was inhabited not merely by Mongolic and Turkic tribes, but probably also by Aryan ones. The horse pattern, first established in Central Asia, was a rather stable one. Thus, when the Siberian tribes began to domesticate the reindeer, they treated this animal in accordance with the horse pattern. Conversely, when the horse was first introduced into the Mediterranean world, the borrowers, who had already domesticated and harnessed the ox, used the horse primarily as a draft animal, the way they had used oxen. Hence, when mounted tribes, warring on horseback, appeared at the edges of the Mediterranean world, their appearance caused a great deal of anguish, both in the Near East and in the Greek culture area. Now, it is of the utmost importance to recall here that the horse was not merely the principal means of transportation and the chief battle beast of these tribes, but also the principal sacrificial offering of groups who adhered to the cult of the Great Mother. Since these sacrifices closely resembled totemic feasts, the conclusion that the horse was a parental symbol is a fairly plausible one.
You know, they keep doing the sexual attachment. And of course, the male horse is always viewed as well endowed. And I imagine that's the connection there, Wayne.
Yeah, I think that does play a part in all of that connotation as given here. But we see it's also relating to this cult of the Great Mother. And you could go ahead and correlate this across the board with a lot of different other mythological archetypes of the Great Mother and see that this is an important symbol associated with many of the mystery belief systems and mystery cults of the past, all of these different mystery series like the Bacchic mysteries, or particularly this one always stands out to me, the Egyptian mysteries of Isis, Isis being directly related to the Great Mother figure that they're speaking of here. So this permeates across all different cultures and mythologies and things like that too. And you have these same archetypes ever present, and the horse has kind of become the stand-in symbol here for some of the other beasts of burden in the past. So it's taken on a new type of essence when it was introduced to the Mediterranean world. And it invokes a type of respect, a type of fear, and these kinds of emotional attributes when it's viewed as a symbol in those regards. And it's related to this whole notion of the mystery of Isis, if you want to call back to the Egyptian mythos with all of this stuff. So that's wherein they tend to lead in this work that we're reading from here. They're talking about all these connections, and I think they make some reference later to some of the Amazonian cultures and some of the connotation with horses there, and the inversion principle being applied, whereas the feminine energy is more prominent there. Thus, they're riding on top of the horse, and that this is actually something controversial in the old Greek cultures and stuff like that as well. So you see, we have all these different connections and connotations here to the spiritual attachment that is symbolized through the horse allegory as given here.
So let's end hour one. We mentioned the wind horse there, so I'll pull us over to Tibet to close out hour one. And I would recommend everyone should take some portion of their life to look at other spiritual traditions. And Tibet is a fascinating one. For learning the mind sciences, if for no other reason. But when you begin to look into these things, the amount of complexity and specificity tied to the natural world is mind-boggling. And I have read accounts where Westerners used to go over there, and the people who lived there had the idea that you come from a different part of the world and your memory is not going to be enough to be able to do what we're doing here. And I always found that fascinating. And if you think about it, if you had 100 generations where people were doing things like memorizing basically word for word, something like a dictionary, and they were doing things like that, it's crazy. But the wind horse, most people should be familiar with because of the prayer flags. People have seen them. If you go to Mount Kailash or other places, those prayer flags are always there. Typically, there's 5 colors, and in some, there's 4, and they relate to the cardinal directions. And in those directions, you'll see mythic animals like a Garuda dragon, which is becoming less mythical, the white tiger and the snow lion. But there is a prayer flag with a wind horse on it, which typically relates to the human soul. And it's a similar idea maybe to incense, where in a church or somewhere, you're saying your prayers and the smoke is lifting your prayers to heaven. They put these flags in the wind so that the vibration and frequency makes them flutter, the idea being that they're propagating these prayers. And you should take a minute to look up the iconography of the wind horse and the prayer flags. And another thing, most people see the prayer flags, people with an open mind anyhow, who haven't been taught that their way is the only way and everyone else is going to burn in hell. When you look at them, there's a pleasing aspect to it. And the reason for that is those are primary colors. They're just lifted from the rainbow, and they're then equated out to the cardinal directions. But the wind horse is an interesting one. You could look up an image to see what it is. Are you familiar with the wind horse at all, Wayne?
I'm only slightly familiar with the wind horse, but the connotation is always there. We always have these basic philosophical precepts behind all of that. Wind, which is the philosophical elemental version of air, being related to spirit. So there you go. It's the horse representing the wind represents spirit, the human spirit. And we could see this connection to the spiritual. So the horse represents a connection to spiritual worlds or spiritual realms. And we see the beauty in what you just said about those flags and how it connects and can carry the prayers, and same thing with the puff of smoke, all related back to these same elemental ideas once again. And I always find these core elemental, philosophical, elemental ideas at the heart and soul of everything. When you really look across all the different bounds of the different cultures and traditions and things like that, you always come back to these same basic precepts. And always, 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 you will find that things like air and fire represent spirit, whereas water and earth represent form or physicality here, the body. So these ideas are always inherent and they're always important to consider. And it just shows the depth of the meaning of the symbol itself when you really dig that deep into it and see what's attached here. So it's a spiritual component. It's kind of like a spiritual parent idea of the human being in some regards, if you look at it from the positive light. But if you look at it from the negative light, this spiritual attachment can also be a negative thing. And that's what we need to be careful of. So in and of itself, it's a neutral commodity. When you look at the horse as a symbol and all this talk about possession and the dream states and all of these things, it's neutral, but there are some negative aspects to it as well. And I think they take center stage in some of this based upon things we've seen happening in the world and all these negative attachments that have happened. And it has to do very much with what we know as the etheric double, because this is wherein the machinations of all of it operates when we're attaching different spiritual concepts to the human being themselves. And I'm sure we'll get more into that in hour two here.
Right. I think the main thing, and as we close out with the wind horse, is it's maybe the difference from our point of view is there's a spiritual tradition that doesn't really have an artificial connection. Everything is measured from nature and integrated with nature. So in terms of the wind horse, it's basically the idea of the human soul traveling through the wind. In other words, now it's got legs. It's like the Pegasus, the flying horse, and it's going to travel upward carrying the prayers. And it's like the duality here. Are we looking at that every coin has two sides? On one side might be the nightmare. On the other side might be the wind horse used in prayer and spiritual endeavors. But Wayne, do you have anything more you want to add? I think we're getting close, Jason.
No, there's nothing more I'd like to really add at this point. I don't think we could maybe just transition to hour two then.
Yeah, we're going to pick up with some of the Rosicrucian stuff, Rudolf Steiner and the human double. And by the way, there's a book called The Human Double. I grabbed it. I read it. Steiner's an insider in my view, but who can doubt what's on offer, which is so much of the writings. And again, I've covered it many times. It seems like all this was secret up to a point when the people in charge of this information near the end of the 1800s said, oh, you got to give this to everybody now, or something like that. But Jason, are we there?
We are there.
All right. This has been hour one of episode 671. Hour one is free to everybody at crow777radio.com. That is crow777radio.com. Members know to log in for the full episode, and members get access to all the forums and comments sections. They get access to all my printable solar images, some of which can print up to about 55 inches or anything less. They also get free access to Shoot the Moon, which has 10 awards in the world, covering my lunar and kind of UFO-type things, telescope work. But more than anything, we've reached the time of the year when my scope can safely go back out now that it's not freezing. I will be picking up filming the sun during the era shift, and the membership that supports us here gets exclusive access to that. With that, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back for hour two, and I hope to see everyone logged in as a member. There it is, man. I'd like to wish you all a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era. Cheers. We'll be right back.
belief is the enemy of knowing.